Frequent presidential candidate, consumer advocate, and citizen activist Ralph Nader joins us this morning to discuss his new book, How the Rats Reformed the Congress. It is a fable about rats that invade Congress and trigger a people's political revolt. In the book, rats have invaded the toilet bowls of both the Speaker of the House and the Minority Leader. The mighty rat invasion sparked a national news frenzy. Activists seize on the burgeoning story to organize for a populist agenda. Spontaneous rallies break out everywhere. The activists see the rats upending business-as-usual routines on Capitol Hill as a powerful symbol against the lobbyists and their corporate Congress. Ralph Nader first made headlines as a young lawyer in 1965 with his book Unsafe at Any Speed, which led to congressional hearings and the passage of a series of life-saving automobile safety laws in 1966. The new book is How the Rats Reformed the Congress. It is a pleasure to welcome Ralph Nader back to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. It's always a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. It's always good to be on WAMC.
Give us a sense of how you came to this fable to tell us about what is going on, not just in Washington, but pretty much in every congressional district in this country.
You know, back in the 70s, Joe, we put out Who Runs Congress in many editions. It was the best-selling nonfiction book on Congress in American history. And I wanted to put out another one, an update, and the publishers said, you know, who's going to read that? And I was sort of overwhelmed by that comment because Congress is the smallest but most powerful branch of government. And if we want to change anything of significance in our country, whether it's energy or health insurance or living wages or waging peace or curtailing waste, you got to go through the Congress, 535 of them who put their shoes on every day like you and I. So I said, well, maybe if I do it in a fictional way, if I do it by a fable that has a lot of realism in it, it will get through to people because this fable, How the Rats Reformed the Congress, is really written for people back home who want to know how they can impact their Congress in significant ways, because there's almost nothing back in the congressional districts in terms of civic mobilization to make Congress face up to the necessities and rights of the people instead of being a toady for Wall Street and all the corporate lobbyists swarming on the corridors up and down Capitol Hill. So I wrote this book. I dedicated it, by the way, to Voltaire and Mark Twain.
Nice duo.
It's designed to make people laugh themselves seriously into organizing Congress rat watchers groups or Congress watchdog groups in 435 districts. And the website, it gives them very serious guidelines on exactly how to do it. So if they go to ratsreformcongress.org, they not only can get the book, they can get this guidelines that I've not seen before on how to start Congress watchdog groups. And you can start it with 5 people, 10, 20, 30, 40, and pretty soon you're going to have a letterhead, and pretty soon you're going to get the attention of your senators and representatives. And of course, all the citizen groups back in Washington that have all the members all over the country, like Public Citizen, Common Cause, People for the American Way, they can't have much influence in Congress if they don't connect with organized people back home. And so I wrote this book. And by the way, there is a rat infestation in Washington, D.C. It's at record levels. They're swarming over everywhere because so many parties and banquets and garbage cans. And there's a rat infestation in Congress. So I figured that we'd lead with the rats. And the rats are not given anthropomorphic character. It's not like Mickey Mouse. They just go where rats go for food and water. And some of them started going up to the into the toilet bowls of some leading members of Congress. And, of course, that created a huge hue and cry and fear, which the members of the Congress tried to cover up. And a Damon Runyon-type reporter pieced it together, broke the story, went out all over the country. Massive derision came back onto the Congress, the late-night comedy shows, people just saying, well, they can't even control the rat infestation in Congress. And then the book gets very serious because so much attention is given to the whole rat episode by the people around the country, so much TV, so much radio, that some citizen groups around the country say, hey, we finally got the people paying attention to the Congress in whose power they've given enormous authority under the Constitution. Now's the time to organize and take back our Congress and turn it around so that it transforms our country in long overdue ways. So, and the rest of the book is how they pulled it off.
There seems to be the old adage that you are well familiar with, that I grew up with, which is people, the American people generally, have a poor view of Congress, but they like their own congressional representative. What do we do about that?
Well, that's because each member of Congress does some good public relations back home. You know, they show up at graduations, they send birthday cards. But that observation you just made, Joe, is less and less true. You're right that the collective polls on Congress are now below 15%, 10% sometimes.
Right.
But they're also declining for the members. Nowhere near that level, but they are beginning to decline. And this kind of mass cynicism is self-destructive because Congress is the only Congress we have. We the people are the preamble to our Constitution. The Constitution doesn't mention the word corporation or company or political parties, just mentions people, persons. And we have delegated under the Constitution our power to 535 men and women who, if they are not watchdogged, if they don't know where they're coming from back home, are going to turn the Congress into a monster, into a clear and present danger against the American people on behalf of some 1,500 lobbying corporations. And the book demonstrates that. The back of the book has a very succinct criticism of Congress. And when you look at it microscopically and telescopically, as we have over the decades, it's pretty outrageous what Congress has done with our tax money, what Congress has done not overseeing the executive branches, what Congress has given away to Wall Street and corporate welfare or crony capitalism, as the conservatives call it, how they've turned their back on the most fundamental economic health and safety issues. I mean, the Republican Party has to take a lot of the blame for this, but we'll see what the House Democrats do now that they control the House. But you still have a $7.25 federal minimum wage. That thing has been frozen for 10 years. Yeah. You still have 29 million people who don't have any health insurance and another 30 million who are underinsured. And people die when they can't get diagnosed and treated in time. About 35,000 Americans die on the average every year, according to a Harvard Medical School peer-reviewed study. And nobody dies in Canada or France, Germany, Norway, England because they can't afford health insurance. They're insured from beginning, from cradle to grave, as they say. And the Congress has done nothing on this. And so if you really want to raise your expectations, citizens, about what your Congress should be doing on your behalf, reflecting your authority, reflecting your necessities, reflecting your concern for your children and grandchildren, this is the book. And what I've noticed, Joe, is we have this book available in paperback and also discounted if they get five. And we've gotten 40% of our requests. People want five copies. And I'm wondering, is this the beginning of a living room discussion around the country where people begin feeling the texture of their own power and not giving up on themselves and not saying, oh, I'm not into politics? Well, politics is sure into you if you're not into politics.
You have, as you mentioned a moment ago, there is a very succinct list in the back, you have bullet points. And I want to just pull out one here to talk about, which is congressional majorities have surrendered their sworn constitutional duties to rein in presidential outlawry and boomeranging illegal wars. Well, that's the one that it seems to be getting a lot of attention right now as far as what can people do, especially as we approach the 2020 presidential election. So I'm interested in the people who are getting five copies and sitting in the living room and what they can do, because if anything else, the last 2 years has emphasize what you've been saying for decades, and it seems that people are listening more. I'm curious as to how we do get people back to reining that in, because you look at what's happening now and you think, well, these are flagrant abuses. People, it seems as if it would be easy to turn your back on this and say, no, that's wrong, and yet they don't.
Well, let's examine it. The last few presidents have felt they could engage armed power in any countries they want. They can send drones, they can send special forces, they can send missiles from ships and helicopter gunships without congressional authority. And so, for example, George W. Bush and Dick Cheney invaded Iraq without a constitutional declaration of war. They spent money in other countries without congressional authorization and appropriation. Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, went to Barack Obama and said, you got to topple the regime in Libya, which was starting to cooperate with Western countries and had disarmed its weapons of mass destruction. And Obama said, okay. And somewhere in the Pentagon budget, they spent the $1 billion or $2 billion to topple the regime, and the rest has been violent chaos spilling to six African countries, hundreds of thousands of casualties, and there's no real government to speak of in Libya. Now, notice this was done without a declaration of war. The money was not appropriated by Congress. It was not authorized by Congress. So that's the most extreme expression of what I call presidential outlawry. And, of course, Donald Trump is doing much the same. He's taking the same trend and sending out gunships and drones and everything. But here's where there's light at the end of the tunnel. You remember a few years ago, Obama was considering sending soldiers to Syria. And something happened, and he said, I think I'll ask Congress for authority, approval, a resolution. And that hit the media big time. I'm sure WAMC reported it. Yeah. And back came massive emails, letters, and phone calls saying no. 97% of the messages said to Congress, members of Congress, your senators, your representatives, no, we're not going to have another Iraq. And Obama didn't send the soldiers there. So you see, how much effort did that take, Joe? I mean, really, how much time does it take for everybody to do their citizen duty here and there on various things and focus on Congress? I think if I had a banner that I wanted to spread around the whole country, I would say, it's the Congress, people. It's the Congress. I've had leaders who are freaked out with climate disruption and climate crisis, like George Soros and Al Gore and Tom Steyer, and they really get it, and they talk about it. And I said, well, there's nobody lobbying on Capitol Hill. The environmental groups have given up on Congress, controlled by the Republicans. They call it gridlock, and nothing's happening. The environmental groups are working on regulations by EPA and other things, but they're not going up every day to deal with the climate crisis. And the staff came back and they said, well, the Congress not where the action is, got to be back home. Hello? I mean, sure, it's got to be back home, but you're not going to get transformative policies shifting into solar, wind power, energy efficiency, replacing fossil fuels and nuclear without going through Congress. And so that's what I'm trying to get, this 535 of them. And they are so used to going back home for these town meetings where 90% of the seats are empty in the auditorium that if people would just get a petition, here's my best estimate, Joe, if they had a petition signed by 300 people, clear, legible addresses and what their occupation and profession are, you'll get a congressman coming to a town meeting created by the citizens back home on the agendas of the citizens back home. And 500 names would bring a senator. That's how little it takes. Now, why is that important? Because it's hard to get through now to Congress. We get complaints all the time. We can't contact the congressperson. We can't contact the staff. We can't get through. We're not donors. We're not on the screen of the switchboard in the member of Congress offices to see if so-and-so calling made a donation. And so I said, well, bring them back home. Bring the senators and representatives back home without their flacks, without their PR. You can just eyeball them directly. And that's all it takes. And that's why in this book is so important, How the Rats Reformed the Congress, is because it shows people exactly how to do it. It gets people to elevate their expectation level of what they deserve and what they've paid for but they haven't gotten by congressional action, and how it can make life so much more pleasant, whether it's modern public transit, whether it's cleaner air and water, whether it's rebuilding schools and sewage systems and helping libraries and establishing community health clinics, all the things that people have sent money to Washington for, which are going overseas in trillions of dollars with criminal wars of aggression. These are not shades of gray. These are criminal wars of aggression. The polite phrase is weapon wars of choice. And we're just boomeranging more enemies against us and more countries. Started out in Northeast Afghanistan. It's now in over 20 countries, whatever names you want to give these groups. And they're draining our federal treasury. And worst of all, we're passing the debt on to the children and grandchildren. We're not paying for these wars the way we paid for prior wars in American history. We're just going deeper and deeper into debt. So that's the connection between blowing up public infrastructure in Asian countries and Middle East countries and not rebuilding and renovating public infrastructure here at home, which, by the way, creates good-paying jobs that cannot be exported to China.
Ralph Nader is our guest. The name of the new book is How the Rats Reformed the Congress. Let me ask you a question. You know, one of the things that I love about you is that you certainly spread blame around. There is a lot of people to hold accountable, all of the members of Congress that you mentioned, of course. You've been doing this since the late 1950s. Have you, sir, ever seen our system, maybe not as broken as it's ever been, but to have people, whatever their party affiliation, have people coming to you and are genuinely scared about the prospects of democracy and our Constitution and where we stand as American people?
Yeah, I think it's the worst in 50 years. I think in the 1960s and early 70s, we got a lot done. In fact, there was a book out by Mike Perchik, who was the chief of staff for Senator Warren Magnuson from Washington State. And the title of the book that came out last year was When the Senate Worked for Us. So we actually got through significant legislation that have saved hundreds of thousands of lives. Auto safety, cleaner air, cleaner water, monitoring all kinds of hazards, giving people opportunity when they're wrongfully injured to have their day in court under tort law. It was a remarkable 7-8 years. And part of what made it possible was the mass media covered it. They covered congressional hearings in those days. Now you don't even have congressional hearings. You know, under the Republicans, they wanted to usurp states' rights on the common law of torts. People are wrongfully injured from product defects or bullying or whatever, and can go to court, have a trial by jury. No public hearing. They got 5 bills through the House. Fortunately, it was blocked in the Senate. Then they had the health care to cut back on Obamacare. No public hearing. Then they had the tax cut for the rich and the corporate. No public hearings. People should understand this is unheard of in American history. So How the Rats Reformed Congress talks about how Congress closing out the people. They're open to business, but they're closed to the people. All kinds of ways. They're not letting citizen leaders testify on judicial nominations the way they did. They're not having hearings on things that really affect people in their daily livelihood with their families. They're not even publishing the hearings and reports and on time. And here's the real kicker. When they change the drafts of the legislation, they sometimes give lawmakers 5-10 minutes to read all kinds of pages before there's a vote in the Senate or the House. So that's why on the cover, back cover of the book, How the Rats Reformed the Congress, I say Congress itself is a concentrated tyranny of self-privilege, secrecy, exclusionary rules and practices, avoiding key public hearings, abandoning oversight of places like the Department of Agriculture, Department of Commerce, the Pentagon, Secretary of Treasury, and so on, and shutting out citizens except campaign donors. So we can turn all of this around. I've often said it just takes 1% or less of the people back home in congressional districts, Joe, to turn themselves into a Congress watchdog hobby. You know, most hobbies take 300 to 500 hours a year, I'm told, and people will spend about $500 a year on their hobby, whether it's collecting coins or stamps or what have you.
Right.
We don't have a congressional watchdog hobby. So less than 1%. My guess is there are 2.5 million adults in 435 congressional districts. That's 1%, 2.5 million adults. So cut it in half, and so it's 1,250,000, one half of 1%, one out of every 200 adults joining a congressional watchdog group in every congressional district, connecting with each other and transforming our country through Congress in ways that, I might add, bring both conservatives and liberals together. There's a lot of conservative-liberal support for a lot of things that are not part of the divide-and-rule strategy of the politicians. And living wage is one of them. Full Medicare is another. Cracking down on corporate crime and abuses is a third. Changing our potholed tax system and its perverse incentives, it's four. Getting rid of crony capitalism or corporate subsidies, handouts, and giveaways at five. And that's what it'll do. It'd be a lot of fun. People have got to get a sense of their own power. They start out with the sovereign power of our republic, for heaven's sake. We, the people. You can't do better than that. And there's no one else named. No political parties, no companies, no corporations. And so it's gotten worse, Joe. You can just listen to the discussion on WAMC, and you will see how much proper blame there is to spread around here in Washington. And you will see the failings and how it reverberates back home. Not that the state legislatures are innocent, but the bulk of the money that's collected in taxes in our country for national purposes obviously are appropriated by Congress. So I want people to get a sense of their own power, not to give up on themselves, to show what their forebears did. They got through the civil rights laws. They got through the consumer protection laws in the 60s and 70s. They made a lot of good changes. But the corporate lobbies counterattacked, built up their lobbying, built up their political action committees. And guess what? The people back home didn't rise to the occasion. And that's why we got this book.
Welcome back to the Roundtable. Ralph Nader is our guest, joining us to discuss his new book, How the Rats Reformed the Congress. It is a fable about rats that invade Congress and trigger a people's political revolt.
Just over the last several days, we've been hearing a lot about, I mean, obviously this comes out of partially from Bernie Sanders announcing his return to the presidential race, but we've heard it from many others. Because the people who want to that in the last election, in the last congressional election, that replaced some of the rats, we were pleased. Oh, we have more women, we have more people of color, we have people of various backgrounds, people are coming forward, we have real contested primaries, and all of this seems to be good for a democracy. But my question is when you look at it as a whole, as we go into the 2020 election. We are hearing a lot about socialism, and I'm curious as to what you make of that, what you make of that term, and what you make of what it means, because I understand it is just a label, and yet those labels seem to carry a lot of weight in our current politics.
Well, they're basically Donald Trump-type smears. I mean, he's a corporate socialist. He had businesses that got all kinds of tax subsidies and eminent domain supports, taking private property for public property. He got all kinds of benefits, but he's using it as a smear. It's nothing more than what Western European countries and Canada have done. It's called social democratic policies. They don't nationalize industries. They don't nationalize aerospace or biotech or banks or insurance companies. Even full Medicare for All is basically government insurance with private delivery of care. The public needs to know that that's the smear that's coming out of the Trump campaign in 2020, big time. Now, let's see what we have in terms of public. We have the public libraries. We have public drinking water systems in communities all over the country. We have the Tennessee Valley Authority producing all kinds of electric power, the Bonneville Authority up in the Northwest. We have the post office. We have a lot of publicly run operations. And you want to call all those socialism? You know, we've always had a mixed economy, but in the last 30 years, it's tilted very heavily into the laps of giant multinational corporations who have seized control of so much of Washington and turned our political economy in what scholars call the corporate state. That's where the government's controlled by big business, Wall Street over Washington, and turned against its own people. And the strategy is divide and rule, make sure conservatives and liberals are at each other's throats, red state, blue state, all the rest, when on the major issues confronting human beings in our country, there's huge conservative and liberal support. And I just noted some of them. So this Bernie should be easily able to answer that. I always thought when somebody's accusing Bernie in Texas or Alabama of being a socialist, that he would say, really, I come from one of the most Republican states in Vermont, and they keep electing me in a landslide. I must be some kind of socialist. Basically, it's distributing back the taxpayer dollar away from the big companies who have gobbled it up in terms of inflated government contracts, in terms of corruption, and in terms of corporate subsidies, handouts, giveaways, bailouts. That's what Bernie's really all about. He's saying, look, people have paid for this. They've earned it. It's time to give them back what they've earned and what they deserve, and that includes a minimum wage.
Since his retirement from the Oval Office, President Obama has often said that you get the politicians you deserve. Do we deserve Donald Trump?
No, and he lost the election. We should always remember he lost the election to Hillary Clinton by 3 million votes, but the nasty Electoral College took it away from her. And the Electoral College, thanks to New York State and California, Maryland, and 7 or 8 other states, is on the way to being neutralized, Joe. I don't know if you know this this group, the citizen group called NationalPopularVote.org, and it only has 6 staff, run by a fairly wealthy retired businessman in San Francisco, Steve Silberstein. And he decided that he could persuade state legislatures, like in Albany, that they would give their Electoral College votes to whomever won the national popular vote as a presidential candidate. So that, in effect, neutralizes the Electoral College without going through the constitutional process of repealing it, because the Constitution gives state legislatures the authority to set the electoral rules. And they're up to 181 now out of 270 electoral votes. In other words, something like 12 states with 181 electoral votes have said what I just described, and they need X number of states to. Once they go over 270, then no one can win the no one can win the popular vote without winning the Electoral College vote.
But so far, it is blue states, right? I mean, it is blue state. New York, Maryland. I mean, they're not the problem.
No, New York, Maryland, Connecticut, Illinois, California. They've already passed
right.
the laws that I've just described. Do what every other country in the world. If you win the popular vote, you win the office. Can you imagine winning the popular vote in 2000? Gore did it. Winning the popular vote in 2016, Clinton did it. And they lost the election. I mean, there's no other country in the world that has this absurdity. What's coming up? We've got a lot of progressive candidates running for the Democratic Party. They're going to be bumping into each other. I don't know how they're going to handle the primary debates, but at least important issues are back on the table. They're not taken off the table. I might add, by the way, your reference to Barack Obama, I guess we get the ex-presidents we deserve, because he's watching Donald Trump destroy everything he did, and he's not mobilizing the public, even though he's the most popular politician, according to the polls in the United States. He spent a lot of months relaxing, and he was tired after 8 years, but he has not exerted the leadership that he could all over the country. He's gone around and supported some candidates for a few days, but I don't know how someone can be 8 years president and watch the tearing apart with very, very bad rhetoric against him by Donald Trump and not lead the citizenry to challenge him. It doesn't make sense to me, other than he doesn't really care.
Do you really think that's true? I mean, I don't want to believe that, and I don't think I do believe that. But it seems to me that there was just an article about this in the New York Times about him being cautious and thinking that perhaps in some ways he could cause more damage than help. I certainly understand your concern, but isn't the jury still out? I mean, don't you think we'll see more over the next 2 years as 2020 comes closer?
Well, let's look at the last 2 years. Trump has destroyed the Environmental Protection Agency. He has called climate crisis a hoax. He has destroyed the expansion and protection of the public lands. All this was part of Barack Obama's legacy. Barack Obama really wanted to phase out coal. He didn't quite say it, but his policies were in that direction. Coal is a deadly polluter. It takes at least 35,000 lives a year, just in terms of coal-produced pollution. Now, what would you do if you were an ex-president? Would you say, well, it is the tradition of ex-presidents not to go after the incumbent president, because the incumbent president can then go after the ex-president's record.
Right.
But these are serious times, Joe.
Yes.
These are serious times. He's still very popular. There's no leader of the Democratic Party anymore that's an incumbent. And so he has to ask himself, what am I going to do with my political capital? I think part of it, I hate to say this, is he's intimidated by the vicious rhetoric that can be hurled at him day and night by Donald Trump. Donald Trump is intimidated a lot of powerful people, people he's appointed to office who's left office under his barrage of denunciation, much of it false, and they just slink away and they keep quiet because they're not about to go through each day being part of Donald Trump's slanderous tweet tornado. So, but that, you know, if you're really a tough politician, you rise to the occasion. You refuse to be intimidated because you have a position of visibility that amounts to a great deal of trust in the American people. I mean, you carry a lot of trust because he gets headlines, Obama.
He does.
He carries a lot of trust. So, you know, it's easy to rationalize being quiet.
But to your point, though, to your point of we the people, If we're the ones who are outraged, and we're the ones who have the power, and we're the ones who see these diatribes day after day after day after day, and for many of us are horrified, absolutely horrified, it is ultimately up to us, right? I mean, we don't really need a leader in that sense, if I'm reading what you are saying in this book correctly.
You're right. It is up to us. But then what happens if no one shows up for the town meetings? No one shows up for the marches and the rallies? That's when you say you got to have a leader that can draw people to these gatherings. You have to have a celebrity, unfortunately. You're right, though. I mean, but the celebrity brings people together. Then people start feeling their own democratic power. It shouldn't require that. It didn't require that near where you are right now in Western Massachusetts in 1774. The farmers rallied around the Tories in the local towns and basically said, if you don't renege your loyalty oath to King George that resulted in taking over our town charter, we're not going to do any more business with you. And you'd get 500 to 1,000 farmers. Imagine that in those days. Quietly surrounding the house of the local Tory representative of King George, places like Worcester and Pittsfield. You don't see that anymore. It's half a democracy showing up. We all know that. But we all know that the few concerned citizens who try to get more people who agree with them together to show up, they just don't show up. They're not showing up in law schools. People come of prominence and to talk about the constitutional crisis, the war-making powers being abused. They don't even show up, law students. So that's why you have to have some of the political celebrities be the magnet to bring them to their seats so they can discuss their concerted democratic power.
So final question for you is, are you optimistic? Are you optimistic? I mean, I'm optimistic in talking to you by just the fact that you have people buying groups, many copies of your book. People want to talk about this. I see it in our events here at the radio station. People want to talk about things. They want to talk about politics. They want to talk about issues that they didn't seem to want to talk about before. If there is, after day after day, after being hit over the head of news that makes you just want to go under your bed and never come out, it does seem like there is some positive momentum that perhaps we can be optimistic about.
Yeah, well, first of all, philosophically, there's no alternative to optimism. I mean, what's the function of pessimism, right, Joe? It just gives you excuse to quit, to drop out, to not be a factor in our democratic society, to not hand it over to our posterity in better shape than we're likely to do if we opt out and quit. So optimism is a very functional approach. It also leads to creative ways of building a democratic society with justice and liberty and freedom and the rest. So that's one. The second is, if you look back at American history, and you make a list of all the great things we inherited, it never took more than 1% of active, organized citizens to pull it off. Even the women's suffrage movement, even the civil rights movement of the 60s, never had more than 1% giving hours every week, marching, picketing, licking stamps on envelopes, telephoning, buttonholing lawmakers. It never had more than 1%. So that's a real optimistic observation, because, good heavens, if we can't get one or one out of every 100 or 200 adults to get the process going for us, and then we can show up and believe something's going to be done, things are worse off than we could ever have believed. I remember years ago when we pulled together citizen groups to get through the Clean Water Act, or the Air Pollution Act, or the Product Safety Commission Act, or the Auto Safety Act, or so importantly, the Freedom of Information Act of 1974, our big expenses, Joe, were long-distance telephone calls and postage stamps and envelopes. Well, it's all free now, essentially. You got the Internet. What's our excuse? What's our excuse? But leadership is key. I mean, I don't want to flatter unnecessarily a WAMC, but I turned it on the other day. If my memory's correct, you had an hour on the patent system and inventors. Is that correct?
Correct.
This is amazing. I mean, you got all kinds of knowledgeable people calling in. And I said, someone else who was listening to the program, you'd never know. There are all these knowledgeable people about innovation, invention, the patent office, how to renew it, how they used it to build their business. Well, we would never have heard that if some one person didn't say, hey, I bet you there's enough support, enough listenership to have a program on invention. So you see, that's what leadership is all about. And leadership also is about speaking one's mind. I mean, Alan Chertoff doesn't like me particularly. He said that on the program. But he speaks his mind, unlike almost any other person on public radio of that prominence in the country. I mean, just look what he says about Donald Trump. And he'll even chide Schumer, Senator Schumer. So this idea of, you know, public radio just here's one side, here's the other side. We have to have people speak their mind, stand up and speak out. Otherwise, nothing gets done. It just becomes like a ping pong game.
I have to get you two together. I think you would like each other if you sat down and talked to each other.
Well, I go up back a ways with Alan.
I know.
Some things that we disagree about that he never forgets. But like he doesn't like third parties.
I know, but I still think when you sit down, as you say, at the importance of speaking out, and it would be nice to have everybody on the same page. Ralph Nader, I love speaking with you. I really appreciate you reaching out to me and the friendship that we've had, and I so appreciate the time that you give us and sharing your ideas, and most importantly, for the incredible, amazing work that you've done over the many decades you've served this country.
Well, Joe, my main message to the people is, you want a great country, it's easier than we think. Let's roll up our sleeves as citizens, use the we the people sovereign power, and make our politicians and big businesses be our servants, not our masters. And that's why it's so important to support public institutions. That's why it's so important to read books. That's why I've written this short book. It's a lot of jokes and funny things in it, but out of it comes a serious pursuit to start these Congress watchdog groups. All you got to do is go to ratsreformcongress.org. You can get the book or books, and you can also get the free instructions on how to mobilize in your congressional district.
The website is ratsreformcongress.org. The book is called How the Rats Reformed the Congress, a Fable. Ralph Nader, a great pleasure. Thank you as always, sir.
Likewise. Thank you, and WAMC.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, How the Rats Reformed the Congress, a Fable. And you can find out more by going to ratsreformcongress.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.